you love to watch these big time college games, and it's tremendous fun. It's a tremendous spectator sport, and football, basketball. But why exactly should they be associated with colleges? What's all of this got to do with what colleges are supposed to be doing?
Sports and American Social Values, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
The National Humanities Center is pleased to present the concluding segment of a discussion about sports and American social values with three scholars trained in philosophy. The participants in the discussion, speaking in the following order, are William Bennett, director of the National Humanities Center, Robert Bryan, professor of philosophy and religion and head of the athletic council at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, and George Schur, a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont and a scholar in residence at the center. Here is William Bennett.
We said that sports teach excellence, or often exemplify excellence. And a good coach will encourage his players to be better, maybe even excellent. There are other things that sports teach. At the same time that they teach you not to set limits for yourself that are too confining. We all know the stories, and I think they're true, of people simply getting better and better and saying, you know, I couldn't do that. There's someone who plays on the touch football team we have who, you know, couldn't catch a pass, didn't know which direction offense was, defense was, whether we were hiking or playing defense. And after a few months, it's catching the ball, catching deep passes in the end zone, and there's a kind of discovery of new powers, new abilities, which is nice, and one's improvement. At the same time, interestingly, maybe ironically, it's also a way to discover limits. Things you can't do. When I was in school, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a halfback, you know, a scat back. And as I grew up, still wanted to be a scat back, but I don't have the body, you know. And I tried, and I prevailed upon the coach to let me run an end sweep, and I got, you know, six of the linemen, you know, got to me before I got outside the tackle, and found out, you know, couldn't be a scat back. You know, one piece of advice we give to kids often in talking about sports and about academics too is you can be anything you want to be. Not true. Most of us can't be defensive tackles, can't be scat backs and the like, so it teaches that. Other things that come to mind that it teaches, it can teach, if it's well taught, like anything else, it can be taught well or mistaught, it can teach a kind of patience, that you don't always get it right, that you persevere, the value of persisting at a task until you're able to get it right. One of the things it teaches that I don't think is talked about very much that I really value, and I think I've learned from sports, is respect for contingency. that things just don't work out the way you plan. People who start playing sports will say, let's take touch football again, we'll be going out for a pass, and we'll drop the ball and come back and be puzzled and say, well, I know how to run, I know how to catch wide, and I drop it. And there really isn't, maybe the physiologist could, you know, watching closely, physiologist, psychologist, and the philosopher watching closely could give an account. But often there's no account at all. You just dropped it. You know, when the pro comes back to the all-pro split end, comes back to the huddle, and the quarterback scowls at him because he was wide open, and he hit him with a beautiful pass, the receiver looks at him and says, I blew it. And that's probably all that can be said. There's no real explanation. It happens. And then, you know, and expanding the context a little bit, a team you're supposed to beat and don't. A team you're not supposed to beat and do. And you can point to this and point to that, but there are elements of chance and, say nothing of role and...
Ah, yes, chance, luck, roll, all of that. But I think that you can give accounts of some of these other things. The pro dropped the ball because he lost his concentration, and or that's one of the reasons.
That's a way of saying.
Well, I don't know.
Okay. Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Yeah. You know, among the virtues taught by sports, and you are citing. Certainly very important ones, is discipline. Another is discipline, that one simply gets control of oneself. And of course, discipline is necessary in cultivating the skills and then in maintaining those skills.
There's another aspect to this, too. You guys have both been talking about what you learn from playing. My own experience has been that I learn more from not playing, since I'm not a terribly gifted athlete, and I would go out for teams and would be on teams, but would spend a lot of time sitting on the bench. I didn't like it very much. It was terribly, terribly bitter, but I really think that it was an important experience for me. What I learned, I guess, basically was there are people better than me. Hmm. That's an important thing to come to grips with. I think it's also important to sit through your disappointment and to try to work through to some kind of mastery of it, to come to terms with it, to realize that it's not the end of the world, however galling and bitter it may be. I suppose other people have less fortunate experiences as bench warmers, but it can at least be a terribly valuable thing.
I think it also teaches loyalty. This is another concept I think that one frequently hears in connection with sports, and I think it's true, that you develop loyalty to the team, loyalty to a community, individual loyalties, commitments. I think these are all important virtues that one does in fact learn in sports and athletics. Mm-hmm. Cooperation as well, obviously, in team sports.
What critical is there to be said about sports? You were talking about loyalty, Bob. There's loyalty to the contract lawyer, the guy who can get you the most money. There is loyalty to the city that you enjoy living in the most. And we come back again to the ethics of individual athletes.
Well, you know, sports are carried on at the professional level, and sports are also carried on at the collegiate level. And we all know that intercollegiate athletics has suffered some scandals here recently. And the NCAA, which is the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the governing body of intercollegiate athletics, has a manual which is 300 pages thick. And it gets thicker every year as new rules, new legislation are introduced. A recent piece of legislation which functions to regulate eligibility, and of course that's terribly important in intercollegiate athletics, is legislation having to do with satisfactory progress toward a degree. Now, in the past, each institution simply had its own standards for satisfactory progress, but now the NCAA imposes rules on each institution, and the rule is generally this, that in the year prior to any given season, the athlete who's participating in that seasonal sport must have passed 24 hours, which really amounts to four courses each term, must pass 24 hours of work toward a specific degree. And so your question is, should it be more regulated in certain areas? It needs to be more regulated and continues to be more regulated, at least at the collegiate level, with which I am most familiar.
Bob, do you remember the article in Esquire about a football player at UCLA who went through 4 years of school and never once spoke to a professor and rarely passed a course, but played football for, I guess it was 3 or 4 years, and is functionally illiterate. Are these myths? Do these things really happen in college sports?
Well, I'm not acquainted personally with any of them. I really cannot conceive of that happening at UCLA. I don't know how that's possible. I just don't see how that's possible.
These are exaggerations, then.
It's all I can say is I don't see how it's possible for a student's transcript to register that he has passed courses that he hasn't passed or didn't attend.
Then I'm interested, then, what's your reaction to something like this long series that appeared in recently in Sports Illustrated, citing, you know, large number of offenses, anecdote after anecdote? I mean, I'm prepared to introduce discount factor, that some are exaggerated, some are not true, but it's plain, isn't it, that some places are playing fast and loose, transcripts being altered. I mean, we had that business and from kids going to high school to college. Wasn't that the Arkansas or Oklahoma situation, wasn't it? Where some transcripts were altered and sent people.
Well, New Mexico is the...
Okay, well, whatever. But I mean, there are cases mm-hmm. where people yeah. I guess, what, where in these cases of these colleges, where, from your experience, and you, I think, are closer to this than any of the rest of us, is the responsibility? Is it in the athletic department? Is it in the ethos of the school? Is it in the president of the college? Where do you look, or is it all these places?
Yeah, all these places. You spelled it out very nicely, including the ethos of the school. First of all, the coach himself must be an honorable man, and you try to hire coaches who are honorable. And then the director of athletics must both be honorable and must keep his eye on things. And then there is a faculty chairman. That's what I am at North Carolina State, and I take a look at transcripts, and I take a look at records of students' work at the end of each semester. Then the general ambience of the university, I think, is a factor in all of this. Altering transcripts is a very bad thing to do, and needless to say, there are rules in the NCAA manual against altering transcripts. A point raised earlier about the overemphasis on winning is responsible for this kind of thing.
I have a question for both Bill and Bob, and it's a question that I'd really like to know the answer to. It's something that my wife bugs me about periodically, and I don't really have quite know what to say to her. She's always asking me, look, you love to watch these big-time college games, and it's tremendous fun. It's a tremendous spectator sport, and football, basketball. But why exactly should they be associated with colleges? What's all of this got to do with what colleges are supposed to be doing? I mean, the easy answer, I suppose, that it's educational, that it, you know, we've been talking about what it teaches kids. I'm not sure that's a satisfactory answer. Just about any aspect of life is educational. And the question that my wife really is asking me is, what connection does this sort of educational experience have to do with the sorts of knowledge and the sorts of skills that colleges teach?
Yeah, well, of course, you've asked one of the big questions. Of course, a counter question is, well, what is a university supposed to be doing? You tell me that first, and then I'll tell you whether or not athletics ought to be going on there. Just all sorts of things now go on at universities, including all sorts of courses and all sorts of curricula, from badminton to hotel management. At my own university, for example, a student may be enrolled in the School of Textiles, or he may be enrolled in the School of Forest Resources, or design.
But Bobby can't literally major in football.
Right. What else goes on campuses? There are fraternities. There are rock concerts. Are frisbee throws.
All right. One might ask the same question of a lot of those activities.
Well, again, I say you're going to have to tell me why it ought not to be going on. It seems to me, because all sorts of varied things do go on a university campus.
But let me can I press George's point a little further? Maybe not. Maybe where's the burden? When I did a study, I don't know what the facts are on this now, but when I did a study of several universities, major universities with major sports programs, found out that if you really counted everything, that sports, even at a big-time university with winning teams, was a losing proposition for the university, that it actually did not bring in as much money as it spent. And if a citizen then, let's say George's wife or other citizen so disposed, says, well, now you've got to meet the burden of proof. What would be the elements of a response? Wouldn't one say, for one, well, it is good for school spirit, for purpose of identification. It makes the experience of one's identification with the university more enjoyable. It creates a sense of teamwork, solidarity, friendship among people at the same school, besides making sort of hostile, or at least playfully hostile toward people at other schools. But wouldn't people say, well, school spirit and identification and some sense of place?
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Soundings is pleased to present the concluding segment of a discussion about sports and contemporary American social values with three scholars trained in philosophy. Speaking in the following order, the participants in the conversation are Robert Bryan, professor of philosophy and religion and head of the Athletic Council at North Carolina State University in Raleigh; George Schur, a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont and a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center; and William Bennett, the director of the center. Here is Professor Bryan.
Frankly, I think that that inter-institutional athletics are simply inevitable. I can remember as a kid, my neighborhood would get up a team and play another neighborhood. You two might be interested to know that the National Humanities Center challenged the philosophy department at North Carolina State to a touch football game here not long ago. Mm-hmm. It's just an inevitable kind of phenomenon, it seems to be, and it's just what one would expect.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. People are going to be forming into teams and challenging other teams and playing at all levels, no matter what there is or isn't at the organized level. But one might turn that and make it an argument against big-time college sports. I mean, since people are going to play these games anyhow and are going to have fun doing it anyhow, why should colleges be so deeply involved, and why should it be such a big part of the organized program of a university?
Again, that's a complex question, calling for a more complex answer than I'm going to give you. But it seems to me that that intercollegiate athletics is a social institution reflecting complex social attitudes. And social institutions evolve and are not brought into being by fiat or legislation. And so what happens, it seems to me, is that let us say my neighborhood, George Street, is going to play your neighborhood, Elm Street. And what we do is we make sure that we get the best kids we can find for our side, and you make sure you get the best kids to play on your team, and then it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
The arguments we've made for sports, I want to just take this one more point. I've made them, and I when I was working for Boston University, a number of students responded and said, again along the lines that George or George's wife was speaking, said, exactly, we believe in all these blessings, that's why we believe more people should be involved. Why don't you put the budget for sports and distribute it more equitably among all the students? More intramural playing fields. We got a hockey team, we got a football team that's 3-8, but there aren't enough playing fields for frisbee and touch football and softball. If the blessings are so great, and George did talk about some of the blessings of being a spectator, but if people say, well, it's in playing that we, you know, can learn these things as well as other things, why not let more of us play? I found it a hard argument, especially with a losing football team that wasn't bringing in much in alumni contributions. Anyway, the one thing I've said, not to answer that, but to in some ways deal with the same question, is it always has seemed to me that the pros should subsidize, and take this budget point away, should subsidize colleges. Well, that is, I think that with the profits they're making, they could afford some subsidy to universities. Since colleges really are the farm system of professional leagues, we have this in baseball, and the major league teams pay for it, or organizations pay for it, why shouldn't the pros subsidize colleges and take away some piece of this budget?
Yeah, and I believe this. If you attempt to justify intercollegiate athletics, especially intercollegiate athletics at the level at which my university plays it. If you attempt to justify intercollegiate athletics simply in terms of the values that accrue to the participants, you'll never succeed.
Yeah.
There's a distinction to be made here. I think, Bill, your suggestion that it would be only fair in some sense if the pros did subsidize what are essentially their farm teams. That does, I think, answer the question of why colleges should allocate what are increasingly scarce resources for this sort of activity. I'm not sure it answers the question why this sort of activity should be associated with colleges at all.
Yes.
I might say about this notion of allocating scarce resources that at least at my university, and I think it's true, well, I better restrict it simply to my own university, that the resources that are used in intercollegiate athletics are all generated by athletics themselves, either directly through gate receipts or indirectly through gifts made by friends and alumni. That no state funds, for example, not one penny of state funds go to subsidize intercollegiate athletics at North Carolina State, and so far as I know, at any state university in the state of North Carolina.
Can I ask George something, since he talked about college sports and what place they have at a college or this kind of athletics, about professional sports, and particularly a question of money. How do you answer this question, which people are talking about a lot? Is Pete Rose overpaid? Are all these athletes overpaid? Is this two questions? Are these people overpaid? Are their salaries symbolic of something fundamentally wrong about either our values or our society? Or aren't these the charges that are often made?
Well, the first question, I think, is easier to answer. I think it would be very strange to say, within a sort of broader social structure, which allows people to sell their services for what the market will bear, that these particular individuals somehow are doing something wrong and getting all that they can. That would be very anomalous to say that all of the rest of us are free to make fortunes, but athletes are somehow doing something reprehensible if they make fortunes in their few short years. Now, whether all of us should be allowed to amass as much money and wealth as we can, I think is a harder question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What about problems, for instance, that crop up about individual conduct among athletes? Billie Jean King has taken an awful lot of heat lately for her announcement that she conducted an illicit lesbian love affair. Should she be condemned? A lot of people are condemning her. On the other hand, a lot of people are standing up and saying, well, you know, it takes a lot of courage to make this announcement and take the heat that she's taken. Or does that really not have anything to do with her ability as an athlete? Is it simply her celebrity that's involved?
Well, I don't know that in terms of her ability as an athlete, I don't mean this sarcastically, whether this negatively affected her. There's this old saw about, you know, no sex before the big match, but I don't guess this would make any special difference that it was a lesbian affair. I think someone like Billie Jean King has to recognize that she is in the public eye. And the notion that what one does privately is somehow no one else's business is a luxury and a bit far-fetched. We are, those people who are celebrities are going to, I think, have to conduct themselves in ways that, not just on the tennis court, but off the tennis court, in ways in which they're prepared to take public scrutiny. Whether the public scrutiny is justified or not, they should recognize that to some extent they do live in a glass house where people will be looking at.
How can sports be made better, Bill?
A couple things. I think, although I agree with George that there's no reason to say that if this is what the market bears, then this is what their salaries will be, 700,000, 800,000, that's okay with me. At the same time, I get the feeling that, as Niebuhr said, human desires grow with the means of their gratification. And if the owners and the players keep making money such a matter, at least in their official statements, of importance, I'm going to lose interest. At college level, I'd like to see more autonomy, if you will, left to the players. I think you should maybe pick one game on the schedule a year in which you put the coach in the stands. This is not a suggestion original to me, but I don't like the. I wouldn't enforce this by an NCAA regulation, but I don't like the coach calling in every play. I think be good to see what the kids came up with on their own. Put them through all week, tell them all the situations, but then let them make those decisions on their own. I just like to see more of that. I like to see it more in the hands of the player at the time the game is played.
I quite agree with that, as a matter of fact, and I agree with it not only because I think that it's the player's game; they're out there, and they should be playing it after all, and that it it generates the kind of virtues that you're after: self-discipline, you're responsible, that kind of thing. But I also can't help believing that they would do a better job of it.
Yeah.
They're out there. They know whether they can beat that guy across the line. And the split end comes back into the huddle, do you see? And he says, now listen, on that last play, this fellow did so-and-so. On the next play, let's take advantage of that. We can't because the coach just sent
in
a play from the bench. So on all these counts, I think that let's return the game to the players. You know, we've been talking for the most part about organized athletics, either at the professional level or at the collegiate level, even all the way down to the Little League level. But, sports, for me, are the sorts of things in which all sorts of people in all sorts of way engage. All three of us here at this table engage in them simply because they're great fun, a word that I used earlier. It seems to me that in athletics, there's a sense of adventure, a sense of risk, a sense of putting it on the line, that that everybody who's able to do it, I'm not sure whether I can generalize this way, but for lots of people, that's a very exhilarating kind of experience, and I would recommend it to all my friends.
I don't know if I might add, I don't know if the others would agree with me, but you had us all here because you wanted three philosophers to talk about sports. One of the nice things, I don't know if George or Bob would go along, about sports, a game, tennis match or a little touch football game, is that it is both concrete and finite, and is in some ways a relief from a great deal. You know, it has a beginning and it has an end. And you know, these philosophical questions you sort of make progress on, but they never end. And you don't win it or lose it. And it's both of those things, and a lot of our work is neither concrete nor finite in that sense.
Right, and you know the rules. So this is terribly important, you know? And to live a civilized life, it seems to me, is to live by rules. And so you, in sports, in a given game, you commit yourself to a certain finite segment of existence, which you carry on according to certain rules. And you begin it, and you end it, and you've played by the rules. And I just think that's terribly important.
You know, talk about morality, talk about values. You know, one of the things that's not talked about so much in educators' talk about morality and values is the word that's come up a number of times here, and that word is character. And I think that consistency of practice or performance, taking a task, again, maybe I'm thinking too much about organized athletics where one goes through a regimen, but it can I think help develop that.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. What good are sports in American society? That's the topic this week on Soundings, the Center's radio program. I hope you'll join me this week for Soundings.